well, let's get started.
Yay.
Welcome to the MS CIC meeting. I did start the recorder. You see on the agenda we got a few things to discuss. We'll go through those. I think we'll have plenty of time for open discussion today. Thank you all for coming, especially as we get closer to the holiday season. Sometimes these December meetings are not as heavily attended. So first of all, I guess introductions. I'm Curtis Baker with AMATS.
I'm Heather Reidel with AMATS.
I'm Fred Wise, bicycle advocate.
Bill Mackey, Citizen Involvement Committee.
Bill Seepy from the Task Force.
Jeff Garden, AMATS staff.
Sarah Finance, AMATS staff.
All right, so we're happy to have everybody here. First thing on the agenda is the draft 2019 Active Transportation Plan. This is the culprit of the largest printouts, or just about. So, if you go through the document, we're pretty excited about this. What we tried to do was talking more. We had a lot of conversations in-house about, you know, what the purpose of our plans really are. We've come to the realization that, you know, writing a plan that's 100 pages long, it's not really, it doesn't really serve anyone from the standpoint of we want to, you know, we feel like people are going to pay more attention and really what are we going to task ourselves to do when we think about improving active transportation in our region. And so really what we did is we separated it out by bicycling and also by walking. We discussed the existing networks of both. And then we really set out more for ourselves goals of what things that we're trying to achieve and that we want our members to achieve in this plan. So you'll see we analyze crashes, and we talk about the existing networks. I think really what we're trying to focus on a lot of is like, we think it's really important to start promoting and pushing a zero death target for bicycle crashes and pedestrian crashes. You know, right now we probably get anywhere from 6 to 10 fatalities in a 3-year period. Sometimes we'll have 3 or 2 in a year. It all just depends. But I think having a mind on that when we're thinking about what type of infrastructure we're building is really important. We also, thinking about things like education and safety, we want to try to create more opportunities for workshops and public empowerment events like our bike and brainstorms to get people involved. And then we're also focusing on making sure that we spend the money that's available for bike and ped infrastructure, making sure that we spend it and spend it on the infrastructure that we need. On the ped side, there's an additional recommendation discussing safe routes to schools. We're trying to shoot for 100% participation in the safe routes to schools program from all our school districts. Daryl had done some research, and I think unfortunately
there's 52 school districts in the AMATS area, and there's only 9 participating in the safe routes to school. I'm fortunate to be sitting on the Akron Public Schools Safe Routes to School Committee, and we do. It's headed by Summit County Public Health, Christy Cato, and Josh Allen from the Akron Public Schools. And they're very aggressive in some of the events that they try to do to get kids to walk or bike to school, as well as going down to Columbus to petition for infrastructure funding that the state of Ohio gives to these programs. So, 52 total school districts and only 9 participating. We'd like for that number to increase.
And the impetus too of Safe Routes to Schools is K-8, you know, feeling like they can ride their bikes or walk to school and encouraging that. And I think the reality is, you know, there's a lot of school districts in our region where we can still, you know, encourage kids to do that type of stuff. It's not just Akron. I mean, Hudson's involved. Stowe, I believe, is involved. I think we have the list of who's done
who it. Is, yeah.
But like there's a lot more that we could get participating, and I think that it's something that we're gonna push our members to do, and it's a little bit different because you have to work with the school districts as well. You can't, the community can't just do it. The MPO can't do it. It has to be through the school district. You'll see on page 11 and page 12 are our maps and recommendations for shared use paths. So the one area where we sort of deviate from benchmarking goals and objectives is we still think it's really important as the regional planning agency to provide what we think are really the goals of the region in terms of shared use infrastructure and what we want to see built. On there, I think just as we've discussed before, the Everett Road project is on there, is recommended. We do have a footnote that was asked for by Summit County Engineer's Office to, and actually we have to fix it because they'd like us to include that Everett Road is currently closed and barricaded and with plans to vacate by Summit County Engineer. So we're going to include that language. However, it is on the plan, and I think I think we still see it as a viable trail option if we can find the right partnership to get it built. The other projects that you'll see are, we've got the Heights to Hudson projects through Hudson. We have elements of the trail that the task force has talked about, connecting all the way down into Akron. We, even though Metro Parks has sort of walked away from a little bit, like we still are big proponents of a north side connection, which would take the Metro RTA line down to Freedom and then connect to the north side train station so that you could get, basically, then you'd almost have this, this nexus of three different trails all within a very short distance of each other, all connected. That we think is really powerful. And I'm trying to think if there's any other notable ones other than we're still actually showing that Metro-owned line from South Akron all the way down through Green, even though there is active train service on it right now, and I believe the lease might be even in the 50 to 90-year type. But when we've talked to our communities, we think that it's still a powerful thing to say this really is a right of way that can be used. I'll stop there if there are any questions on specifics about what's sort of shown there.
You'll see the questions. Yeah, there's 36 that we recommend, and then there's 4 that we have funded. So you'll see the word funded next to 4 of them. The Barlow Road Trail, Bike and Hike Trail, you'll see those on there. On the chart, on the list.
We'll talk about that in the projects. We'll go through that.
On page 14, we show the sidewalk inventory.
Yes.
And I suppose that's nice, but it's very confusing. And maybe we should... people who live in the area sort of know where their sidewalks are at. Maybe it'd be more impactful for the public and the policy committee if we show where there are not sidewalks that need to be done. Granted, this belongs to the cities or the townships to get the sidewalks built, but maybe something generated that would.
So not just the absence of sidewalks, but the actual gaps, like where a sidewalk should be.
Yeah, and like you have on your
sidewalk inventory,
the shared use path recommendation.
Okay.
You could show.
You think we should have more like specific pedestrian recommendations?
Yeah. This is a half a mile of sidewalk. It goes from here to there, and it would help hook up. Jones Shopping Center with some urban or residential area where people could use a sidewalk to do this rather than walking out into the street.
Right.
Sort of an impact. Here's why you need the sidewalk in there. It's a different way of looking at this. I know you have to have the inventory, but from the inventory you can do something that would get the cities or the townships to say, oh, we should put a sidewalk in there because AMAT says
right.
so.
And we didn't we didn't expressly do that, but one thing, if you look at page 20 that we did, was we overlaid the bus stops with the sidewalk. So one of the things that we do with the sidewalk inventory is it gives us the ability to see how other things interact. And on that map, you'll see areas that are identified where we have bus stops where there is no sidewalks. So if we were going to draw that map, because one of our recommendations is building sidewalks where there's transit infrastructure.
Goat paths.
Yeah, and
if there's goat paths, I would think there's a need for a sidewalk.
Right, sure. And so therefore, we could take this one step further and actually highlight some of those routes that you're seeing that show that there are people that are using those stops where there are no sidewalks.
Yeah, I think of Gorge Boulevard and Cuyahoga Falls Avenue, where it cuts down to the gorge, goes mm-hmm. over to the mall. You turn left like you're going to go down to the river, and there's a bus stop on the right-hand side. And it's in the middle of a grassy field. And I'm going, who the heck lives near here where they're going to walk down across a grassy or snowy area to get on a bus there? I think I've seen one person there in years of passing by there. And there's no sidewalk. The sidewalk across the street goes down to the trail area and the gorge. But Metro's supposed to be evaluating the stops, number of people that pick up at each stop. I'm going, why is that stop there? I don't know who would be getting on or off, because there's no living in that area unless you walk back in the North Hill. Or
yeah, I think those are good comments.
Yeah, good idea.
And, honestly, I know, and it was probably me that said, we don't need to do specific pedestrian recommendations. And I think sometimes it's because, I think I see trails as being very regional. We're talking about these larger scale connections. Sidewalks are very local, and they're almost, it's, mm-hmm. and so I think sometimes I feel like, we can, when we show a line like that, coming out, you can't do that there. The residents will do, I think, whereas the trails, for whatever reason, we can at least be like, we're able to vet them. There aren't
right.
any of them.
Right.
But I think it's a good comment.
Well, but if you see goat trails.
Yeah, I'll give you credit for that good comment.
Thank you, sir. I do read these.
Yeah. What do you say is in here with the goat paths? That's what it starts.
Yeah, the term is now part of your lexicon of official terms in transportation.
It's funny, because I was actually thinking about that, and I was, we call that a goat path, and that's what it's been termed in a lot of ways. Part of me thinks, are we actually, by using that term, really, it's a human path. Why are we referring them as goat paths?
Well, it's like out in the forest, you have deer trails, but you never see deer on them,
Yeah.
But,
it's sort of like that, I guess. But, are there any questions or any other comments? Or I'm looking at you, Fred.
No, we really need to spend some time going through this. A lot of it, I'm sure, we've already talked about at some point.
Yeah.
There is one question that you raised. You talked about the safe routes to schools. And I have been working with an inner city school, Mickey Bright. And that's one of those areas where you certainly could bike to, because it's all neighborhood areas. Except that I don't know how you would go about doing that. You get the situation, if you bike to school in the morning, it's raining, you're not going to bike back home. How do you bike back home? What kind of things is the group that's doing that? What are they trying to do to make that an effective thing?
Well, outside of applying for infrastructure funds, which would, it really does entail a lot more than just identifying the crosswalks that are dangerous and making them more visible, possibly doing, a light or stop sign or something. It can get into, and Nick Mayer from the Engineering Bureau with the City of Akron sits on that committee too. He does a lot with deciding, if the street could be turned into, complete streets or a road diet where we can funnel and slow traffic down through corridors to make those kids feel safer, and parents too. But we've done What we tend to do is events that raise that awareness. So we did do a walk and roll at Mickey Wright. I'm going to say it was an 18, you know, to raise that awareness that kids could do that. And what are the challenges for that, you know, from getting a child that's a quarter of a mile away to the school safely, whether they're walking or riding their bike or rolling on a skateboard.
Yeah, and I think the thought is that this would never be, like, you know, it's not even doing it every single day. You know, like, I mean, obviously, if the weather's bad, you might not ride your bike, or you might, you know. But I think it kind of goes hand in hand with just this, you know, I mean, everything from, like, child obesity to, you know, all those things of getting them out there and getting them safe and getting them active. But I think, like, what Daryl was saying is true, is, like, really anywhere they can in those areas to just slow traffic down and make people, you know, make the vehicles feel like they have some responsibility to also watch the wind and be looking for kids in these areas, I think is. I think Daryl had, I don't remember what school district it was, but you did that, was it, they did this.
Walking bus?
The walking bus.
CLC, the walking school bus, first time ever.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, we believe the marketing was out there and kids, you know, were sent, everything was sent home, you know, continuously to get that word out that instead of riding a school bus, we want you to get to the corner, someone will be there, we'll walk you to school, and unfortunately the turnout isn't so great. And then on the other hand, we go to Hudson at Eastwoods Elementary School for a walk and roll event, and there was a picture on one of the slides I was going to show you. The amount of bicycles that day, it just blew me away, because I think all of the Akron Public School events that we've held don't add up to the amount of school just for that one day. You know? So I don't know, you know, there's
my perception with Mickey Wright was that I last year I was able to get time at during the school day to come in and teach kids to ride and work on safe principles at the same time.
Yeah.
Didn't happen this year because they switched their periods. I could no longer get a 40-minute period section of time to get the kids together. Plus the fact they really don't, you know, they got one bike rack there and that's it. There's no, they don't really, as a school, encourage kids.
Yeah, there's a lot of hurdles that we have to.
But yeah, and I think like Daryl was telling me, even, you know, there'd be issues where he'd be on the rolling bus, the walking bus, and you know, he'd see a student like get in his mom's car, back out, turn around, and to drop him off at the school. You know, and so I think it is. I mean, it's going to be a slow process for some of these places. I mean, you know, but at the same time, I mean, I was down by off of Middlebury off of what's that coffee shop called? Compass Coffee, and I was got myself turned around. And I went back in that neighborhood. And this was in the summer, and there were all these kids riding bikes in the street with, you know, no helmets, no attention to direction, no supervision, and, you know, I'm creeping into the intersection like, hey, you know, here, like, just trying to, you know, so I think it's just trying to raise awareness with those kids about that kind of stuff. I think it's really important, but it's a challenge. I think with all the stuff that Daryl, you've done in Akron specifically, you know, it's hit or miss. It really is.
But being one of the five E's, education, encouragement. I think we really do a pretty good job in that, those two, education and encouragement. Five E's, the American League of Bicycles.
And this does kind of, I mean, we can continue talking about this, but it dovetails really nicely into the traffic crash report, where we do talk about bike and ped safety. But that's sort of the next thing on our agenda. What is that? 6E? No. 6E. Well, it's the agenda. Then there's a packet.
Yes.
Yeah, 6E.
And really, if you look at, I think Dave did a, our staff did an excellent job, as well as Amy on our staff, looking for the pages that had the tables that were really so in page 10, I think, is where I'd like to start. It's got the kind of line graphs that shows us sort of what's happened over the last 3 years, so it's 2016, 17, and 18. Mm-hmm. And so what you see is that total crashes just about remain the same. Injury crashes for vehicles have been reduced. Serious injury crashes are going down. Fatalities have really dropped this year or dropped quite a bit in 2018. And, you know, fatalities has been a big discussion lately, vehicle fatalities. And sadly, we've had a few here in 2019. So I'm not sure where that number is going to go. But, you know, trying to monitor those ebbs and flows and why we think they might be taking place. Bicycle crashes also went down, and pedestrian crashes, at least when it comes to injuries, went down. But we had roughly about the same. Pedestrians didn't really change much at all. So I think when we look at our this report, basically what it does is lays out sort of the top crash location. We look at some of the main reasons that people are getting hurt. It also sets performance goals. The state sets for safety in order to get additional safety funds. But I think overall, I mean, I hate to say use the term business as usual. It's not that, but you know, we don't seem to be making like a huge dent in crashes. Overall, our bike and ped, if you look at the peds over a 10-year period, we haven't done real well. If you look at the bikes, we've gotten lower. And the one thing that's difficult about both bicycle and pedestrian crashes is, unlike vehicles, where vehicles we can count them, so we know, hey, there's 10,000 vehicles that go through here and there's 50 crashes. Next year when there's 40 crashes and it's still the same 10,000 vehicles, we know we've got a reduction. Like, my assumption would be that a crash rate of bicycles has actually gone down even more than what we see, because I think more people are riding than a decade ago. But because we don't have that volume, it's a lot more difficult to measure for both that and pedestrians. As Dave likes to say in our office, everybody's a pedestrian at some point. And so, you know, we're all, whether you're in a parking lot or walking down the street, at some point you're going to run into conflicts with vehicles. We sent out a PSA this year regarding October being the highest month of pedestrian crashes. We actually even looked specifically at Halloween to see if... Halloween is not just on the 31st anymore. You know, neighborhoods have their own dates on weekends. But it really doesn't seem to be that. For whatever reason, we think it has to do with the time change and the sun being lower in the evening and just sight visibility. We tend to have this spike in pedestrians. And yet, at the same time, it's interesting, we don't see that same spike with bicyclists. So the bicyclists actually spike in the peak of summer, in July, and it kind of starts in March, it creeps up, and then by July it starts to slowly go down in December. But with pedestrians, we have sort of this more like a smiley face graph where it goes, the summer it actually seems lower, and then September, October, November, December is higher. We think that's partially because of the school year, so you don't have as many kids walking around as you do, say, in August and September. But we also think it has to do with the light. So those are sort of some of the interesting observations. From a transportation or traffic perspective, Kent East Main Street is still the highest crash location in our region by segment, and the highest crash intersection is on Maple Street. That would be Maple and Rhodes and Maple and Cedar. Both of these they've just popped up in the last few years, and they almost function, they don't function as one intersection, but both intersections are very close together. And what we've noticed is there's a lot of people running red lights through that area. It's also, so if you're coming down Maple Street, it's a hill. And so we're thinking maybe there's a visual, something that's causing people to just blast right through those lights.
So there's a lot of pulling.
Right. You've also got the dealerships right there. So those are kind of interesting, but they've held the notorious top spot for 2 years running now, so it's a very dubious honor. But I know Akron's looking at finding ways to fix it. But otherwise, if you go through that, you'll see, you know, we have maps of the high crash intersections, top 50, maps of the top 50 segments as well. And then we also do have the bike crashes plotted as well as the pedestrian crashes plotted. And really what you tend to see with these is there is usually concentrations in areas that are denser. I think you see like Kent around the university, downtown Ravenna, even Hudson. Downtown Hudson has a cluster. The downtowns appear to have some of that activity. But you know, one of the challenges for us is that if you look at like the bike crashes map, you know, there's, and Fred, we've even talked about this. There's, you know, a crash on 303 in Peninsula. And, you know, a guy doesn't see somebody in front of him, his windshield's fogged up, and he just kind of veers into the shoulder and hits him. It's not really an infrastructure issue. You know, it's not something where we can be like, oh, well, we can fix that. And, you know, that's one of the frustrating things is that, you know, when you start diving into these police reports and you read about what happens, it's usually people's sight. A lot of times bicyclists are getting hit because of what people say they can or can't see, or it's kids doing foolish things on bikes. So it's a lot of usually the fault of the kids is they're just rolling down out their driveway and get smacked or something like that. I think for us, we look for concentrations, but it's all not always clear of what the best way to resolve it is. And we actually have this big debate on our staff right now over, I should say, Dave and I about, and with pedestrians, is sort of what should we be doing? You know, a pedestrian has every legal right to walk at night, right? But we know that pedestrians are very difficult to see at night. At the same time, you know, it's not like we require, you know, oh, well, if you want to walk outside, you should be wearing light clothing or, you know, but in a police report, when you see a pedestrian crash, typically the crash report will indicate what clothing the person's wearing that's the pedestrian, even though that there is no law set, you know, but there's this perception that, well, if you're wearing black clothes or a dark hoodie, like, you did it to yourself. And I think the reality is that's not necessarily always the case. But so Dave and I have talked and had these debates about, like, well, what, do you hand out free, like, little LED wristbands for people? So if you want to walk at night, you know, maybe, you know, should you be wearing reflective gear? Unfortunately, not everybody has access to that, but we all have the right to walk outside and get where we want to go. That's another interesting thing that we kind of discuss is, like, what is the best way to promote that pedestrian safety? I mean, some of these crashes, by far, it's somebody doing something stupid. But there are certain crashes that you see that break your heart because nobody was doing anything wrong. And they still get hit just because they aren't seen or they aren't visible or they're walking in a goat path or something like that and people can't see them. So I think as we think about our active transportation plan, we start discussing those types of things is what can we do as a regional agency to help maybe improve some of these safety dynamics, especially when it comes to bicycles and ped. Obviously, for the infrastructure and the roadways, we have money that we can try to engineer a solution. It's a little bit harder with bike and ped.
It would seem like that would be the kind of thing that a major public service training type thing would be, for instance, in schools. You really go and emphasize wearing you know, white clothes, or you get the kids to take the reflective clothes.
Right.
Do something, if you give a strip of something that's reflective.
Yeah.
And
we did light up bracelets.
Yeah.
That would light up, and we encouraged them, you know, this is for.
You need something on their head, a big band up here that turns right.
Yeah. Well, that's another interesting thing, too, is like, you know, we've got all these new technologies, like there's this pedestrian crash technology in vehicles now that supposedly will see a vehicle or see a pedestrian and stop. But what they've found in studies is that they don't see children. Like, children are too low. And then also, if it's dark or there's bad weather, they fail more than 50% of the time with test dummies. So it's like, even the stuff that we're trying to put in on the vehicles to help reduce some of those really horrific crashes, like, technology's come a long way, but we still haven't solved all those problems.
Well, and along that way, when you talk about autonomous cars, you're talking about cars that can talk to each other.
Right.
Does that mean we put a radio transmitter on everybody, you know,
right,
walk around so that you can be located?
Right.
Over in your status of forces agreement, we had on-base schools, but people lived off-base. So I'm not sure if the German government required it or if the base said. But if you had a child who would be outside after dark, you are required to purchase a little reflective snowflake that got pinned to their coat. So they would, that would twirl. And you'd see that on the side of the road. They didn't have sidewalks either. So you would see that. But this was a, I don't know, regulatory thing or
where
societal
was that,
thing.
Where were you?
Right outside of Trier. Northwest, West Germany at the time. So,
as a parent, my daughter, her winter coat has some reflective pieces
sewn into it.
As does her backpack for school.
Oh yeah,
but
backpack.
I know it's not everything.
Yeah.
No, and I think when you realize when you are driving and you see a bike or a pedestrian at night, you realize a lot of times like reflectors aren't really enough.
Right.
I mean, I find that the bikers that I want to emulate when I'm on my bike are the ones that have
flashing
very
lights,
strong strobing lights on the front
LEDs,
and on
yeah,
the back.
Yeah, I've seen some of them.
And, you know, or even the vests where you wear it and your back lights up and all. I mean, sometimes I feel like it's an extra thing to add. But, like, when you're riding your bike, like in that issue in Peninsula, you never knew it was coming. You know, like, you're not going to know if somebody... And so it just seems like safety should be, you know, if you can do it, you might as well. I think the problem with asking kids to do it is just that it's a lot harder, I think, on a day-to-day basis, and the kid wants to walk to school to remember to have so many pieces of illuminating equipment or something like that. You know, it's a challenge. But we've thought about that. It's
yeah,
just ways to handle
yeah,
out
I mean, there are things, but unless it becomes regulatory. Or talk to who's left in the mall now? J.C. Penney up there. You could offer a special for parents to buy their reflective little star to put on your kids' bottom of their winter coat so they can be seen. You know, special safety.
This year, 2019, I would have to do your move campaign. One of the things that did freebies or things that they were giving out was a reflector. A clip on anything.
Mm-hmm.
A clip to it.
Yeah.
A round reflector. And it would
spin.
Yeah. You could actually push it from behind or something.
Right.
It would light up actually. So.
Oh.
No, yeah. We're
so there are
everybody's
items out there, but yeah,
yeah,
other people
yeah,
use
and
them.
And we had a box of them, and we gave away. I mean, you know, the events, Bike Road, you know, we gave those away. And Walking Talk, we gave those away.
Mm-hmm.
Heather, do you want to talk about that?
Sure. I'm not quite sure how familiar all four of you are with our Connecting Communities program, so I'll give you a brief history, I guess, because this week we made available our applications for our fifth round of funding. So So we've done four rounds previously. The program started in 2010. We funded, let's see, the first three rounds, we for each round, we funded two $50,000 planning grants. The last round, we funded four planning grants asking for a match from the communities. So I think we ended up, that round, instead of being $100,000, was like 174,000 total. So regardless, we've given to several different communities the planning grants. It started with the City of Akron and Metro. We've given to Boston Heights. We've given to Ravenna, the Village of Richfield. Montrose received a planning grant. The City of Barberton received a planning grant. And then the last four, we gave those out in 2016. We gave to Green, Twinsburg, Hudson, Kent, thank you. I'm blanking on the last one. So the last round took us quite a bit of time to get through, and we decided that this round we would not require matching funds. We have, the applications were made available on Monday on our website. They are due back to us February 28th of 2020. Our task force met November 15th, and they kind of decided we made available $80,000 for two $40,000 planning grants. So again, the applications are due the end of February. The task force will meet after that, review the applications, and make recommendations to our policy committee in May. Like I said, the one big change is really the local match request. And I think that's about it. That's all. I wanted to let you guys know that we are starting that up again. So
solicit your local community to.
Yeah.
What kind of projects have some of your grants helped the past?
What have they helped? Let's see. Curtis, you'll help me remember all of these. So the Village of Richfield put a sidewalk on a bridge as they were building a road. They also put in a road.
A new road.
Yeah, that's recent. The road opened last year.
It's Kinross.
Off of Wheaton.
Kinross South, kind of, and it's next to Empire. Just got built. I don't know if you've seen that new building. Off of Wheaton Road.
So that road.
Yeah. It was like a land use transportation plan.
Does it have to connect outside the community, or does it just connect?
Right. So it was the impetus to getting the sidewalk funded in Montrose.
And the crosswalks.
And the crossings on Montrose.
And then Barberton's Magic Mile.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with the Magic Mile in Barberton?
Yeah.
So that all came out of the planning grant.
You mentioned Boston Heights. What the world did they do with it?
I don't like talking about that one.
we can leave. But it's a good program, and the communities, what we try to do is get them to think, like, if there are areas where there's future development, okay, how do we plan that development so that it doesn't negatively impact the transportation system? How can we improve it? How can we incorporate things like trails, walking, biking, and that kind of stuff? And the communities really seem to like it, because a lot of the communities that don't have a lot of money, the first thing that they stop spending money on is planning, and so it helps them do some land use and transportation planning, which is positive.
Montrose, they did a sidewalk, and we went to ribbon cutting.
Yeah.
And I think we just approved some more.
Yeah, so now we're going to have a nice L there of sidewalk, which is great for the transit and for all the boat users.
Does something that's in the county have to be through the county if you were to do Boston Township?
Yeah, we actually, Copley and Bath applied for the Montrose one, so it was not through the county engineer's office. So the townships are eligible.
Okay.
Wheels start turning too much. The last thing too, and then we can go to the open session, is I just wanted to turn your attention to attachment 6A. 6A is basically the resolutions, and there's actually multiple resolutions, but announcing or recommending for approval the funding projects that we discussed at the last CIC meeting. So the first page of 6A shows you CMAQ projects that were funded. East Main Street in Kent, West Portage Trail in the Falls, Project in Macedonia, and a couple of bus buys. The second attachment goes through our STBG and TASA and resurfacing. STBG, our largest program, is funding North Main Street in Akron from the Y Bridge all the way to the Cork Line. It's also funding East Main Street in Kent, which we saw was our highest crash location. And then we're also putting $80,000 towards a bus rapid transit study. The tables are attached, so STBG has the first three projects recommended. And then you'll see our resurfacing program, where we recommended 18 projects for resurfacing. And then finally is our TASA program, where we recommended three projects for funding: the Rubber City Heritage Trail in Akron, the Stowe Silver Lake Cuyahoga Falls Bike Connector, which is the piece of the task force trail, is recommended for funding, and then the sidewalk on Cleveland-Massillon Road. So these three pieces we're excited about. Now the work really begins, I think, both for the Rubber City and for the bike and hike. As with the bike and hike, now it'll be about working with Metro, making sure that Metro RTA is happy about where Stowe wants to put the trail, making that work. Getting it over Graham Road is going to be a big thing at some point. But, you know, once we cross over to the pedestrian bridge that goes in the Cuyahoga Falls, I mean, then you're talking about a trail that goes all the way down to the gorge and connects to the Valley View Trail that Metro Parks is trying to build, which would get you to the towpath, et cetera. And then we can keep going southbound on that segment that, you know, through Silver Lake potentially and all the way down into Akron to the Freedom Trail. So I think these are very good projects that are very feasible. So we're excited about them. Any questions about those? Currently, they are all programmed to be in fiscal year 24 and 25, but those things can move up just based on project cancellations and slippage and design, etc. So
you're starting to talk out far beyond where I'm likely to be around.
Oh, come on. Don't talk like that. Bill thinks he's going to live forever. So
it's maybe random and possibly was addressed another day, but the Akron issue one, where they got funding for repaving roads, et cetera, has that affected any of your, I guess, priorities?
You know, that's a really good question. Not really, because what I think Akron, and this is just my, I wouldn't call this fact, this is more my perception, is I think what they're doing is they're attacking the local roads that we can't fund, so roads that are like too small for our system, they're using that funding for, and then they're still coming to us for the federal funds to do more of the major roadway project. The last time around, before they passed issue two, they had applied for three resurfacings through our program. This year, I think they really wanted to focus on that Main Street corridor. And so they decided to forego the resurfacing in order to try to get the $6 million for the Main Street, but my gut tells me that some of that issue one will help pay some of that local match for the for that North Main Street project. But for us, I would say, and just as users of the roadways, what we're noticing is that they're resurfacing a lot more roads that say they could never even come to us for additional funding, which is good because, you know, otherwise those roads probably wouldn't get done.
I remember a newspaper article, people talking about roads in Akron, and the previous mayor said, well, all of our money's going underground to solve the sewage problem that we've got to face under federal law, so we'll just have to let the roads go for a while. Now, maybe when they get that program paid off, there'll be more money to come back up for surface work, but they're under the gun financially, time-wise, everything else, to get that sewage interceptor program finished.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that issue was a big deal for Akron, because I think it also helped. I mean, obviously, we've got two new fire stations in Akron and all sorts of equipment being purchased. And so I think the road part was, what, about a third, I think, was how they were splitting it up. So, but I think, but yeah, the sewer agreement with Akron is definitely, the EPA covenant is definitely a backbreaker in a lot of ways for them. But any other questions on that?
Billy, that question, you sent an email, and I think Dave answered it about
yes.
the coming up 71 and something, some kind of blankets.
Yeah, around the piers, I noticed up out of Cincinnati, the piers supporting the bridges over I-71 have this, looks like a big styrofoam blanket, goes around the pier, little knobs sticking out, the size of soup bowls. And then you sent me a picture of something black, black locally here. I guess it does the same thing. I said, well, it's either got to be a crash reduction thing in case somebody goes through the guardrail and hits the pier, or salt protection, you know, which and you see all those piers where concrete is falling off and the ironwork is exposed in there and the rebar. So, you know, hey, if it would extend the pier another 10, 20 years, it'd be great.
I feel like that's every bridge that I drive under in East Cleveland when I'm on 90. Exposed rebar, they don't look like garbage.
Yeah.
Sad. All right, well, at that point, I mean, we're just going to open it up to discussion, or if there's anything, or, you know, we could also turn the recorder off, too, and continue with the discussion as well. So, I don't know if there's anything else for the good of the order.
Question about Route 8. They're not doing any construction right now down our section. Are they going to remove the barricades and open up those lanes that are available?
No, my understanding is, I was just talking to somebody at ODOT about this, they decided that in the winter it wouldn't make sense, because what the plan was they were actually going to do that separated traffic, you know, where one lane goes over and one lane stays on, and they decided for just motorists' peace of mind during the winter, even though those lanes are done, they're just going to keep that two lanes together through the winter and then switch everybody over come spring.
See how many accidents they can have there in the winter?
Yeah. Well, I think they were concerned about the splitting.
Yeah.
You know, I think just to be honest, that corridor, I mean, we are seeing a lot of crashes right now with it under construction.
There's 85 cars involved in the last one.
Yeah, the snowstorm.
We've been discussing that, for those of you that are familiar with up north in the Seasons Road area. Something is going on there. This isn't meant to sound conspiratorial, but it seems like there's been multiple large-scale crashes due to, like, whiteout-type weather conditions, and there must be something in that, a little bowl around that interchange that's causing, because we haven't seen anything like this. And it's, I mean, when that one happened last year, I was talking to someone and said, that was the first, like, 80-car crash I'd ever seen. Mm-hmm. Well, now we just had a second one that was 50 or 60. And then we had the wrong-way crash that was actually
part of
Falls area. Which that's been a really sad story so far. But, that's my understanding is those lanes will just look really nice this winter. And you drive by them and stay on the concrete.
If they just even just move the barricade, give you another foot or two in those lanes, it would make a big difference.
Yeah. And you can hear more about that project and others if you listen to my podcast.
I listen to the podcast. Yeah,
with ODOT Capital Programs Administrator Chad Root.
That was nice. That was nice.
And then got one with Valerie Shea from Metro. So
get that one.
You know, they're both.
Are you getting
on
them
there.
On the website? Are you finding them? Are you accessing
when you
them on the
email
website?
Me
you
with
email
everything.
You saw it.
And it said, click here to listen to the podcast. Sorry.
The funny thing is that in order to even get it on iTunes or those programs, you have to show that you have established, like, you're going to do. So they won't let you even submit them unless you have three. So the goal is to, like, make them and then submit and actually have them more widely distributed
But they're on our website.
But they are on our
website.
I didn't go to your website. I just did it.
I've got a couple of book deals in the works now.
You're going to put video in there too?
Exactly. Exactly. Some transportation self-help guides I'm working on in my spare time. That's a good question about Route 8, because actually that was one of the questions I asked him was, you know, what's the deal? It's going to be a long project. I mean, it's going to be a couple more years of concrete barriers, and then when it gets done, then that's when they'll start replacing the bridge over the valley.
Yeah. So, that was a nice thing on the podcast, though, explaining how that's going to work.
Yeah.
I mean, so.
It was a year or two ago you had someone speak here about an application to make Route 8 interstate.
Oh, man.
Is that dead?
ODOT does not like that idea because they don't want to have to take over the maintenance throughout the entire corridor. Right now, you know, like it sounds kind of silly, but even like Hudson and, you know, Stowe take care of their portions of Route 8, or they'll have contractual agreements with the local communities. And so while it was a big economic development push, ODOT never really got behind it because they were concerned about the costs that it would be to them, not to the locals.
It was good putting in Route 8.
Thank you.